It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Millions of people are caring for somebody with severe memory loss, trying to find ways to connect. One of the best ways anybody's found is music.
My mom is 89 now and was diagnosed about 2 years ago with what they call late-onset Alzheimer's.
This is our producer, Shannon Henry Kleiber. Today's show begins with her discovery of the unexpected power of a song.
When my mom started memory care, I looked for ways to try to engage her more. You know, this thing about having Alzheimer's and living in the moment is you have all this time, but you're not sure what to do with it.
Mom, are you ready for an interview?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, we can stop anytime you want.
Yeah.
She doesn't have long bursts of communication.
Are you getting a little tired?
A little bit. Not a lot.
Wow.
Two of the things I tried to do were to bring her some art supplies and do some painting or drawing with her, and then I bought her a very simple music box that just kind of had an on or an off. She wasn't really interested in either of those. She just really couldn't concentrate on the pencils and brushes and even the simple on and off switch.
Do you have a favorite song that you like?
Oh, all of those songs.
We usually sing an Irish song for this beautiful lady.
One day when I was visiting, I came into this group of memory care people at Oakwood, and they were playing some music.
Edelweiss. Every morning.
Don't get it.
And I thought, oh, okay, that's really nice. You know, they do a lot of activities. They take the memory care people out on walks and things like that. And everyone was singing and everyone was dancing. There are people I didn't know could get out of their wheelchairs were dancing. There are people I didn't know could talk, were singing every word of every song. There are a lot of people who I know to be, maybe say one word. There's a woman there who has a stuffed cat, and I've heard her say cat. That's all I've heard. My mom doesn't talk a whole lot either. I was amazed.
What is it about music that produced this small miracle and does again week after week? Shannon went back to find out.
So you get the same group together every week?
Yeah. Last week, it was slimmed down because they were playing bingo.
Mrs. Mary, she is the woman who puts together this group every week.
I am 95, almost.
You are?
Yeah.
No.
Yes, I'll be 95 in December.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I get a little tired once in a while.
And she thinks of it as kind of her calling in a lot of ways. Music has always been an important part of her life, and she loves to bring together people who might not otherwise have a chance to sing together.
This is the microphone.
5 foot, are you?
This is
You're
the microphone. 5 foot.
Yes, okay, the next one, 5 foot 2, eyes of blue. I don't know where. 5 foot 2, eyes of blue. Well, as I say, I've been singing since I was a little child. My father was a choir director and soloist and my mother sang and played the piano. We were brought up with music, and it's fun. We would get in the car, and one of us would start a song, and we'd all sing it. It just was part of our life.
Okay, everybody get the page.
It's probably about 15 or 20 people. They came in their wheelchairs and walkers. There's walker parking as we were coming in.
Side by side.
They sing all these American songbook standards. Moon River, Side by Side, Edelweiss, all these really lovely, beautiful, familiar songs from their era. But it's almost like something kind of lights up in people.
Mm-hmm.
It's waking people up, do you think?
Yes, I think so. Do you?
Krista, do you think so?
I agree.
This is Krista Iverson. She's the life enrichment coordinator at Oakwood Village.
I mean, even if we're trying to work with somebody on getting them to go somewhere, you start singing You Are My Sunshine, and they'll come along with you. It's just amazing how well it works. So if you think back to what you listened to during
that
time, you know, you kind of think of when you hear that song on the radio, where does your mind go and where does your body move? You'd kind of revert to that time period.
Well, I was singing, what was I singing today? The one about my name is Jan Janssen. I come from Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. I work in the lumber yard there. And I was singing it to my little great-grandson who was with me. And this man was standing in the garden there, and he started singing with me.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
And and we sang the whole thing.
Is there research behind that? Is there a reason anybody knows that those are the songs that work for them?
What I have heard from researchers is that the music of our late teens to late 20s is the music that stays with us. And it's imprinted on us. It's been found that these songs can trigger memories and kind of wake people up in many ways.
I'm just imagining the future when I'm in a nursing home and we're all like rocking out to Patti Smith or the Ramones.
Right. So for my generation, U2, The Replacements, The Cure, David Bowie, and will I remember all those songs? Like, I guess.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Wow. Do you think there are a lot of nursing home programs like this?
Yeah, so it's proven to work. And what's really become a big deal now is this personalized music and memory music therapy. And
wow, personalized music therapy.
Yeah, so at Oakwood, there's a music therapist, and she asked us what kinds of songs were important to my mom. And my dad and I went through some songs that we thought that she'd really like and that she'd always like. Frank Sinatra, things from Sound of Music, 1950s and 60s kind of music. And then a couple days later, they had put on an iPod about 57 songs.
Can you hear that?
Yeah.
Do you like it?
Yeah.
What song is that? It sounds familiar.
It sounds familiar. I'm nervous.
She always loved to sing. She's a pretty religious person and would always say singing is twice praying, which is why hearing her sing the entire You Are My Sunshine is so surprising and wonderful to me, because it's the most I hear her voice.
I loved hearing you sing You Are My Sunshine.
Yeah, that was good.
Do you like that song?
Yeah, that was very good.
Yeah. Do you remember singing that song?
I do.
When you were little?
Yeah.
You knew every word.
Yeah, I guess that's because my mother and father sang the song to me.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
It does trigger other memories. I've heard other people say, oh, I remember dancing to this song, or this reminds me of driving in a car. It brings out other memories that I don't think we'd otherwise get to.
It's really kind of sobering, partly thinking about how many of us, how many people are going to maybe wind up like the people you visited that day. I mean, Alzheimer's is on the rise.
Yeah, the statistics are pretty shocking, actually. There are 5.8 million people living with Alzheimer's disease right now in the country, and by 2050, that number is projected to rise to nearly 14 million. And it's the sixth leading cause of death in the United States. So unless a cure is found, it is really something that even now it's affecting one in every three senior citizens. It's pretty pervasive. It's an epidemic, and it's something that if you don't know someone who's affected by it, you probably will.
When they sing, it looks to you kind of like they wake up. What does that mean to you? Like, what do you see?
I do think of Alzheimer's as being something where it's almost like living the same moment over and over and over. And what I've seen music do is takes people a little bit out of that moment and gives them another dimension. It's like something is, a light's turned on inside. You walk in and you see a lot of people in memory care in their wheelchairs, and they're just kind of waiting for something to happen, I think. And then the music starts and they physically get up. They start singing. You see sparks in their eyes. It really is something that ignites something familiar and joyful within.
I have to say, hearing a group of memory patients singing about lingering in the twilight is like almost unbearably poignant. You and I reached for Kleenex about the same time, and yet you say they're really joyful and happy.
It is hard. It's definitely hard. You know, they call Alzheimer's the long goodbye because people are slipping away so slowly. And maybe that's why the music seems so especially joyful, because these are some of their last moments of joy.
There's a place for us. God made a place for us. And he, that's it.
But you're, what you're saying is why it's so meaningful.
Because we're not put aside. We're still in a, can contribute to the world. Whatever we do, there's a place for us.
And that's what music does.
Yeah. It is for me anyway.
Yeah. Thank you.
For me.
That was Mary Marol and some of the other residents at Oakwood Village Retirement Community in Madison, Wisconsin. Shannon Henry Kleiber visits her parents there often. I still have so many questions. Like, where in the brain are those musical memories stored? And how is it that those memories can still be there when Alzheimer's or dementia have wiped out almost all the rest? We'll talk about the research next. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, and PRX. Thank you. The person who did more than almost anybody to popularize research on music and memory was the late neurologist Oliver Sacks. He was famous for stories of people with brain disorders, from Parkinson's disease to autism, and he wrote a lot about neurological mysteries, like the one we've been talking about, the way a song can activate parts of the brain that language can't even touch. Back in 2007, he told Steve Paulson about one of his patients.
Tony was a surgeon in his early 40s, very robust and athletic and extroverted, with very little interest in music. And one day, this was in 1993, he was on the phone. It was an outside phone. A storm approached. A bolt of lightning flew out from the phone, hit him in the face, gave him a cardiac arrest, and along with this, an out-of-body experience. He was resuscitated, and he seemed pretty much himself. Except 2 or 3 weeks later, he got what he called a sudden insatiable passion to hear piano music, and then to play piano music, and then to compose music. And in the course of about 48 hours, he really became transformed. He became possessed by music. That was his term. He started getting up at 3 in the morning, and he got a piano. He got a piano teacher. He learned to transcribe. He was at music when he came back from his surgery. He said his wife wasn't best pleased. And basically, this has continued.
And there was nothing in his background that would suggest this love of piano music.
Really, very little, either on the musical side or, for that matter, on what he likes to call the spiritual side, because he now feels that this was a providential event, sort of a divine intervention, and that, in a sense, the music comes from heaven, and he has a mission to bring it to earth. And so there was also a certain change in character, and a sort of a mystical element crept in.
You write about other cases where music is profoundly therapeutic. For instance, you have worked with people with Parkinson's and Alzheimer's diseases, and these people may not be able to talk easily. They may not even be able to move very well, but often those problems seem to disappear when they listen to music or play music.
Yeah, well, this is where things started for me as a physician, and more than 40 years ago when I saw the patients whom I later described in Awakenings, and these people were almost transfixed with extremely severe Parkinsonism, catatonia, these sleepy sickness people, but music could liberate them in the most remarkable way, and they could dance, they could sing, they could move normally, they could think normally while the music lasted. Music can just have an amazing effect in recalling deeply demented people to life, and music has its special uses in aphasia and people who've lost language, because even though they may not be able to speak, they're usually able to sing and often to recover the lyrics of a song.
That's fascinating. So you're suggesting then that the part of our brain that deals with language is a different part than deals with singing, for instance.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This was really discovered right back in the 1860s when it was found that aphasic children could sing. And even though there might be damage in the left hemisphere of the brain causing the loss of language, singing seemed to be associated with the right hemisphere of the brain. Although in general, there's no music center in the brain. There's 20 or 30 different systems or networks in the brain involved in listening to music or imagining music or reacting to music. And I think this is why music is so robust, and even when speech may be lost, other parts of the brain are still there.
Well, you say something astonishing in your book, that neuroscientists can actually spot a professional musician just by looking at the image of their brain.
Oh, yeah, I was very fascinated by this. And I wouldn't have believed it had I not sort of seen this myself. This is beautiful work, especially done by a man called Gottfried Schlaug. And he found that in many different areas, in the corpus callosum, this great bridge between the two hemispheres, in the auditory parts of the brain and in the motor parts of the brain and in the visuospatial parts of the brain, there was a real enlargement of gray matter in musicians' brains. And this is sometimes visible to the naked eye, so that although you can't look at a brain and say, that's the brain of a mathematician or a visual artist, you can look at a brain and say, this is probably the brain of a musician.
So do you think this different brain anatomy is something that is changed as people hone their talent for music, or is it something that some people are just born with?
I'm sure both. And sometimes it's difficult to tease out because people who are naturally very gifted are likely to have intensive early musical training. But there have been studies with people who've had, say, a year of intensive violin training, the Suzuki method, looking at their brains before and after a year, and you can see very clearly the changes which have occurred.
You write about another remarkable case study, the English musician Clive Wearing. Explain what happened to him.
Clive was a very gifted musician and musicologist, pioneer in Renaissance music. When in 1985 he had a devastating brain infection, a herpes encephalitis, which especially destroyed some of the memory systems in his brain. So he developed a profound amnesia, so much so that he would lose everything in a few seconds. If you came in the room, he would greet you. 10 seconds later, you'd be a stranger, and he'd greet you again. And along with this, there was a loss of many memories from his past life. A great deal of his autobiography was gone. So he had lost what neurologists call event memory or episodic memory. He'd lost much of his knowledge of the world, but his ability to perform music and even to conduct a choir or an orchestra at a masterly level was absolutely unchanged.
So he could remember those musical pieces. Somehow those memories came back to him, the musical memories.
Well, let's put it this way. The power of musical performance, the music came back to him. If you showed him a Bach fugue, the printed page, he'd say, never seen it before. But if you just start him on the first note, he would play the whole fugue perfectly and then in some amazement discover that he knew it. So that he possessed a huge memory of which he was unaware, sometimes called implicit memory. And when he was performing music, improvising at the organ, singing, conducting, he seemed utterly himself. Gifted, charming, full of sensitivity and intelligence. Seconds later, he'd have no memory of this, and he'd be confused and disoriented and frightened. So that there was this day and night difference between the two Clives.
That was the late neurologist Oliver Sacks talking with Steve Paulson. Sacks's many books include Awakenings and Musicophilia. Speaking of musical memory, there are other famous cases of professional musicians who lost their memories but could still perform. For instance, there's this wonderful film about the country music star Glen Campbell's Goodbye Tour. He had Alzheimer's. He barely knew where he was or what day it was, but he could still play the guitar and sing. He even recorded one last song called I'm Not Gonna Miss You.
I'm still here, but yet I'm gone. I don't play guitar or sing my song. Never defined who I am. The man that loved you till the end. You're the last person I will love. You're the last face I will recall. And best of all, not gonna miss you.
The documentary is called Glen Campbell, I'll Be Me.
I'm
not gonna miss you.
Music made his final days a lot happier. But it's not just professional musicians who can benefit from making music late in life. After a 40-year career as a psychologist, Francine Toter decided to start playing the cello. Her own experience convinced her that music, and in fact all the arts, may be the best way to stimulate the brain and improve well-being late in life. Her advice? It's never too late to learn to play an instrument. Steve Paulson, who is edging up on 60, does not paint, draw, sculpt, or remember how to play the piano, wanted to know more.
Francine, you say it's in our vintage years that we can best embrace the arts. Why do you think that?
Unless you were early identified as gifted as a child, chances are that you played an instrument for a little while and then life got in the way of continuing. Most kids do give up whatever it is that they've been playing by the time they get to school or get to high school, or it isn't cool to carry a violin case on the bus. And some people never get started. So often it needs to wait until the vintage years. This is a period in life where there is less demand on your time, where your focus can be better. There's a decrease in certain hormones, which we can talk about later, that actually do affect your ability to concentrate and focus and feel peaceful. So often it needs to wait until this time frame when people go, gee, I once enjoyed playing the piano, maybe I should try that again. Or people say, I always wanted to play the piano, do you think it's too late?
Yeah. Now, you are talking about this from personal experience. You started playing the cello late in life.
Yeah, at 70. Yeah, I was contemplating retiring, and I was thinking about a couple of different things that I could do. I'm one of these people that needs structure. I'm really not comfortable imagining a retirement that has nothing in it but time and space. And I thought, well, what is it that I've never done that I would really enjoy? And one of my inspirations was somebody who was a professional cellist, and I just loved the sound of the cello, and I thought, why not? So I did a lot of research and discovered that, in fact, you could really learn to play the cello at 70. And I decided, well, I was going to write a book about other boomers and older adults who really wanted to do something different in the arts, but felt they needed permission because there aren't too many good role models.
So were you intimidated when you first started trying to play?
Well, I was intimidated before I started to play. You know, my kids kind of rolled their eyes, and the professional musicians that I knew kind of patted me on the head and said, well, you can give it a try, but the recorder would probably be a better idea. Because it's a complex instrument, string instruments are, and I thought, but why not? And the more I heard that probably I couldn't do it, the more I wanted to. And of course, when I got the cello, and I actually rented a cello first, took it home and thought, well, I'll just start playing it. And of course, no music came out, and not that I should have been surprised, but I have to say it's almost 5 years that I've been playing the cello, and I can play pretty well, at least for myself. I don't perform for anyone else, and that isn't one of the goals of this stage in life. But I can entertain myself, and right now I'm working on a Vivaldi piece in E minor, which gives me pleasure, and that's the idea.
Now, in the course of writing your book, you talked to some people who are well along in years who did start to play certain instruments. For instance, an 88-year-old man named John who took up the piano. Can you tell me about him?
Oh, sure. For a lot of the people that I interviewed, taking up an instrument or another art form came totally by accident. And in John's case, he was always an appreciator of classical music, enjoyed attending concerts, but had never in his life had the time or really interest in playing an instrument. He was a pharmaceutical executive, very busy life, traveled all over the world. And when he finally settled in an apartment in San Francisco, when he was 80, he noticed that there was a space in his living room. And so he impulsively decided to buy a piano. I don't know whether he was thinking it was going to be a piece of furniture or what. I don't think he really thought it through. But eventually he thought, maybe I should take some lessons. So he decided to do that. And in the course of doing that, while it was also very frustrating for him, because it can be when you... when you're a person of 80 and you like music, you know music really well, and you know how it's supposed to sound. And so it's really hard to be a beginning pianist or whatever your instrument.
Right. It can be really frustrating because you know it doesn't sound like what you've heard all these years.
Exactly. And it doesn't sound that way. But his goals are different. His goal was not to begin a career as a concert pianist. What he told me was, all of my life, I've tried to look at music, and it looks like a bunch of squiggles on a page. I want to learn how to read music. And so he did. He had a motivation. He had the ability to stick with it. He had the energy to carry it through. And he learned how to read music. Okay, so he practices every day. It's become a part of his life. It's as much a part of his life as brushing his teeth. And while it can be really frustrating, it's also opened up a whole community to him. And the most interesting thing that I heard from him was that he can now listen to two pieces of music and listen with an educated perspective that he never had before and tell the fine points of this particular rendition versus that one, even how the conductor did things differently. Well, that kind of level of understanding and appreciation comes from learning how to play an instrument and also appreciating the complexity of it.
Well, it's fascinating because, I mean, you're suggesting that there were certain neurons activated in his brain that allowed him to appreciate music more. There was something going on that enhanced his experience at the brain level.
Absolutely. There really is mounting evidence that playing music, and I don't mean playing it on your iPhone or your iPad or your audio system, can delay or even reverse the onset of normal age-related memory problems in older adults. When I was in graduate school, there was this belief that neurons do not continue to grow after about the age of 30. It's a sort of a slippery slope after that, and that's the end of the story. That's what happens to your brain. Now, fortunately, we know that neuronal production increases, and also there are connections between the cells called dendrites that continue to multiply. And what you need is the right way to stimulate the brain to make that happen.
You're talking what's known as neuroplasticity.
Neuroplasticity, exactly. Now, neuroplasticity happens no matter what, but when you get older, you need to have the right ingredients to trigger it optimally.
And you're saying that, let's say, a 75-year-old can do this as well as someone in their 30s?
Well, the person who starts at 30, the one advantage that they have is they have more dexterity in their hands. They have more breathing capacity if they are playing a wind instrument or something else like that. But the advantage of being at this age is we have time, we have focus. There are changes hormonally, decreases in testosterone and estrogen that actually make people feel more peaceful and more focused, and so they can attend much better.
Francine Toder is a retired psychologist and author of The Vintage Years, Finding Your Inner Artist After 60. Steve Paulson talked with her. Coming up, we'll meet a woman with a vision for transforming nursing homes and the lives of older adults with the arts. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
Thank you.
30 years ago, Anne Basting was a young theater artist when she volunteered to run a program for Alzheimer's patients at a nursing home. And something happened.
So I found myself in a locked unit on the third floor of a Milwaukee nursing home, trying to draw them out. They were in wheelchairs, a vagueness behind their eyes. People just sank deep inside themselves out of self-preservation. Really, after 6 weeks of nothing coming out, you know, I just tore a picture of the Marlboro Man out of a magazine and grabbed a big sketch pad. Let's take a look at this picture and just say anything.
Come to Marlboro Country.
I said, what do you want to call him? And somebody said Fred.
It's the most interesting experiment.
Fred who? Fred Astaire.
Super snapper.
Where does Fred live? Oklahoma. And then somebody started to sing. And the whole group just was like, what's happening? And there's energy and there's playfulness. And one answer was funnier than the next. It was also very poignant. As he married, yes, what's her name? Gina Autry.
Back in the saddle again.
Wow, we have Fred Astaire, who's a singing cowboy, married to Gina Autry.
Put on the ribs.
And they tend cows.
Cow.
What do the cows say? And they said, hi, Pat.
Your cow's gonna kiss me.
I'm like, all right. The cows say, hi, Pat.
Poopy-tie-i-o.
You know, they wanted to be included in the story. That simple little gift fueled 30 years of work.
Come to Marlboro, Marlboro Country.
Oh, yes.
Okay, let's think about this. Storytelling. Just collectively making up a story brought a group of Alzheimer's patients to life. And Anne Basting spent 6 weeks trying to get that same group of people to volunteer a single memory of a place they'd traveled, the name of a pet, their favorite ice cream flavor. They had nothing to say until she asked them to make something up. Well, today, Anne Basting is a MacArthur Award-winning theater artist and professor with an entirely new model of aging based on creativity and imagination. She's developed improvisational storytelling techniques for people with Alzheimer's and dementia, and she uses them in nursing homes to create and stage original plays for public audiences. She says everything changes when you shift away from the expectation of memory and toward the freedom of imagination.
Well, if you're asking someone, do you remember when we did this? Or even the expectation of, do you remember me and my name? There's one answer. And when you're dealing with cognitive challenges or any kind of cognitive disability, the likelihood that that pathway is broken is really high. But if you shift to open the question to what I now call beautiful questions that open a shared path of discovery, you've opened 1,000 pathways.
What's a beautiful question?
So an example is, what is something you treasure in your home and why? Mm. What is the most beautiful sound in the world and can you make it? You know, it's this thoughtful, poetic component of unlocking the world. Mm-hmm. You don't want to have too many cognitive steps in the question, but one that appeals to strength and one that appeals to emotional memory and that has a playful component as well.
The experience of dementia, I think, mostly inspires fear. From the moment of diagnosis, we all know the way the story is going to go, right? Decline, senility, the gradual extinction of what we call personhood. That story is so terrifying to us collectively. It's almost paralyzing. Why do you think we're so afraid of dementia?
We really, in Western culture, prioritize cognitive control, and we subsume the emotional, intuitive experience, which is present all the way through that experience you just described. So that is still there. And there's a lot of forms of memory that are still there, but explicit, rational language is what erodes. And that's where in Western culture, we've put all of our eggs in that basket and we've set ourselves up, plus our general denial of our mortality, which is also packed into that fear that you described. The fear and the denial has allowed pretty terrible care scenarios to take place, that we prefer to hide it out of shame. And so we want to stay independent as long as possible, which means living alone in horrible isolation. We make it worse, so much worse through our own fear, that if we can start to peel that away, the experience of living with dementia is not as pure, horrifying as we make it out to be. It doesn't have to be that way.
Do you see older people or people with dementia or Alzheimer's differently now than you think most people do?
I started very early on when I first started doing this work as seeing the spark of humanity. The power of that is indescribable. You know, that was 25 some 30 years ago. And I now find myself growing into a personal relationship in my own family with my mother experiencing dementia. And it's a new test for me of being able to move through my own fears and my own emotional responses.
Has there been a moment with your mom where something happened, a moment of awakening or realization for you, you know, just a transformative moment?
With my mom, she's very, very early, so it's not, it'll get harder. But the thing I think I'm most proud of is my dad, who's caring with and for her. He tells me stories about how he'll hit a moment where mom will forget something that they'd gone out to dinner with friends just a few hours before. And she'll say, "Do you want me to set the table for dinner?" He could become very upset by that. But instead, he thinks of a beautiful question and he says, "Are you hungry?" Opening that moment to emotion and allowing her to have her own response in that moment rather than shutting her down and saying, don't you remember? He's doing better than I think I could of turning my own work into the caring relationship with my mom.
So we've been talking about this kind of on an individual level. So let's make it big, because so much of what you do now is really about changing the entire healthcare system in order to make this kind of creative, imaginative connection just baked into the way we treat our elders. You've talked about it. There's this lovely phrase you have that you think art should be poured into the water of our care system, which I love. Can you unpack that a bit? What do you imagine?
It's actually just repair work, because I think somewhere along the line, late 19th century, we institutionalized the arts and culture world and the medical world, and they became completely separate. And I feel like slowly you can feel these two monoliths coming back to each other. The world in which human beings express themselves, dream, make meaning, and tell each other stories has got to come back and be part of being a healthy human being and community.
So you mean that we decided somewhere along the line that there's amateur art or art activities, but real art is something only professionals do?
Yeah, you know, I think we created that MFA. Not that that's a bad thing, right? I teach it. This project I just finished in Kentucky with 12 rural nursing homes, like solid Medicaid. You know, we staged original plays that were the most powerful theater productions I've ever been involved in my life.
I Won't Grow Up, right? A Peter Pan story?
Yes.
Why Peter Pan?
You know, it's a very powerful story to unpack inside of a nursing home.
But there aren't any old people in Peter Pan. How does it even connect?
You know what the play ended up being? Because we unpacked it into what we call creative challenges. So the questions became, what does it feel like to fly? If you could fly anywhere, where would you go? What is childhood? What are the feelings and the foods and the tastes and the sounds? And the same thing with adulthood. We unpacked both of those things. When Wendy is literally shot down in Neverland, the Lost Boys build a home around her. And it's a really creepy image of this border between confinement and comfort. Mm. And that is a very powerful theme in nursing homes.
So what did you actually do?
The story became about the nursing home honoring Wendy, who's been living in the nursing home for about 10 years and who's now on hospice, and who's been telling stories of Neverland and enchanting everyone who lives there with her goodness and her stories. They want to honor her at the end of her life with reimagining and staging the stories that she has told them. So they invite in an audience. It's interactive, and they have different stations. One is the positive thought station so that you can fly. One is the fear station where you say what you're afraid of and then feed it to the crocodile, who's a pretend funny crocodile.
And what role do the nursing home residents play in all of this?
They were running the fear station. They were in the positive thought station. They all had costumes and face paint of Lost Boys or fairies or pirates. And you hear an audio recording of these I Am poems that we had done with them as well, stating who they are and what thing in childhood they identify with, a place that's special to them. It's just a really beautiful audio piece. And it comes to the person who played Wendy, who she says, "I am Wendy." And then everyone says, "We are all Wendy." And they turn around to the audience and they say, "I am Wendy. I believe," and they put their hand out. You know, in the Peter Pan story, they do that for Tinkerbell, that she's going to die unless you believe in fairies. The symbol of that is clapping in the Peter Pan story. And in this one, it's just meeting the hand, touching an elder. That scene is so powerful that I had to play the tissue fairy. So I was running around with tissues because people were crying. And once they believe, then we break it and we hear Frank Sinatra start to sing Fly Me to the Moon. And then they go into this euphoric, choreographed wheelchair ballet.
The wheelchair ballet.
It's just a jubilation of you believe, wow, and now we can all fly. And then the last number, as if this wasn't all emotionally completely overwhelming, is the gospel song of I'll Fly Away.
Oh. What's the impact on the audience like?
My favorite story was from Morgantown, Kentucky, where there was a gentleman there who came up to me after the preview performance and said, "I'm the police chief, and my office is next door, and I have not been in this building since I was 12 years old because my grandfather died here, and I wanted nothing to do with this place. And I cannot believe what I'm seeing, and I want to know how I can help." And I'm like, that's what we're trying to do.
It just seems like you have this vision. The nursing home is not a warehouse for the elderly that nobody wants to visit. We stigmatize aging so much that we don't think of elders as capable of connecting, let alone of making profound, moving, even enduring art.
You know, if we just think that elders are facing the end, some of them are living with incredible challenges too, and pushing through and finding meaning and making meaning is incredible.
What you're saying is they have what we need so badly in our culture because we have pushed death and awareness and knowledge of death so far away that, of course, it then haunts us. And they have what we need.
You know, I say sometimes that going out and doing this work is the best therapy I could ever have. Just, I'm brought into the present moment. I'm brought into relationship. Like, incredibly powerful emotional relationships with people. I'm making beauty and meaning. I just love this work.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars.
Anne Basting is a theater artist, MacArthur genius, and professor in the Peck School of the Arts at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. If you'd like to learn how to engage more creatively with the seniors in your life, check out her Time Slips project. You'll find the link on our website at ttbook.org.
Baby, kiss me.
Want more conversations like this one? We keep at least a dozen episodes in our podcast feed, so look for To the Best of Our Knowledge on your favorite podcast platform. Or, if your grandchildren keep telling you to listen to podcasts but you don't remember how, visit our website. Click on the words Get the Podcast. The web address again is ttbook.org.
In other words, I love you.
To the Best of Our Knowledge is put together each week by people who believe in curiosity as a way of life. Wisconsin Public Radio makes it possible. Shannon Henry Kleiber produced this hour, with help from Charles Monroe Kane and Angelo Bautista. Mark Rickers is our digital director. Joe Hartke is our sound designer. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
Fill my heart with song. Let me sing forevermore.
I am Libby.
I am Johnny.
I am Chris.
I am Maureen.
I am Dixie. I'm a lover of all and master of none. I'm a singer, artist, and poet.
I am Dolores.
Deborah.
Daryl.
Damaging.
I love.
I am happy as a lark.
You